Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn. It's official now. I'm not going to Russia. Repeat, I'm not going to Russia. And my mother is over the moon. For years she has lived with this fear, fear that is never spoken about out loud, but which is there, ever present, that at some stage the revolution will take her boys away from her and send them either to a boarding school in Havana, or worse, to a boarding school in one of those cold, distant countries on the other side of the world that are now Cuba's best friends, like Russia. The whole Russian thing came about because of a competition at my school to celebrate the anniversary of the birth of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Nowadays, we learn a lot about Vladimir Ilyich Lenin at school because, as I'm sure everyone knows, he's a great historic figure, an inspiration, not just to the people of the Soviet Union, but to people around the world, according to my teachers. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, we're told at school, is the reason we live in such a great country today, with free health care for all, and free schools, and no one begging on the streets. It's the reason why the smarter kids at school want to learn Russian too, which my friends tell me is a very difficult language to learn, but it will become, for sure, the most important language when the entire world is communist. So, to celebrate Vladimir Ilyich Lenin's birth date, every school in the province has been asked to get the students to write a composition, which can be on any topic we choose, but which I know should be patriotic. A good, patriotic, revolutionary composition. You can just tell that this is what they will be looking for. The student who writes the winning composition in the municipality gets to go to Russia. It's quite a prize, especially for a boy from Banis who loves writing and loves compositions and who has barely been outside Banis. It doesn't take me long to write my entry. It's a story about a group of children in Vietnam, which is another of those fraternal socialist countries we learned so much about at school. Every day on television, at school and in the paper, we learn about the heroic people of Vietnam fighting the imperialist Yankees, who are bombing their families and their schools and killing children with chemicals that burn your skin and destroy your face. I write about children in Vietnam who, after school, go about fighting the Americans, taking secret messages to grown-ups, building traps in the jungle with bamboo spikes, using whatever weapon they can find to shoot down planes with the initials USAF on the side. Except one day, the children get caught in a bombing raid, and one of them is killed by the Americans. Before he dies, he tells his friends how they should turn his blood-soaked shirt into a flag, the red flag of North Vietnam. I'm quite proud of my effort, although I'm not sure whether it will be inventive enough to win the big prize. I can only hope. Within days, I get the news. I have won the competition in my school. I know because one of my teachers rushes up to me and tells me, although she makes me promise not to tell anyone until the official announcement is made. Tonight, however, we get a visit from Ibis, who's a teacher at my school. Ibis has come very quietly to bring the news my mother has been praying for. I'm not going to Russia. Repeat, I'm not going to Russia. There's been some mistake, she says. My composition didn't win after all. It takes me a while to realise what Ibis is saying, but eventually I get it. I'm not going because, well, you know, my parents are not what you would call exemplary revolutionaries, are they? In my mind, I picture a room full of teachers discussing the revolutionary merits of my composition. Then, at the end, when they have decided that my composition is the best, I imagine one of the teachers at the back giving a little cough and saying, "Excuse me, compañeros, excuse me. Just hold on a second. This may be a very revolutionary composition, but do you know that the boy's parents are suspect? You know, his father never volunteers for Trabajo Voluntario. His mother owns a shop, which is a classic sign of petite bourgeois tendencies. And his aunt and uncle are gusanos who left Cuba for the United States." I imagined the room going quiet. No one saying anything. And then after a long pause, someone says, yes, well, here's another excellent revolutionary composition, stressing the word revolutionary, to make sure that this time there's no mistake. So I win second prize. It's a book about Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, of course, with glossy colour illustrations of the Soviet leader standing heroically in the snow and pointing into the distance as if he's pointing the way to the communist future of the entire world. It's a nice book, you know, but it's not first prize. I'm not happy. My mother is. I will never get to Russia. Che is dead. The news has just come in, and it has come from El Máximo Líder. That's how important the news must be. Ernesto Guevara has been killed, Fidel said on television and radio, adding that Che was murdered by the CIA somewhere in Bolivia, which I know is a poor country in South America. Che was killed while fighting the Americans and their lackeys in the Bolivian army, Fidel said, and now all of Cuba is in mourning for 3 days to honour the men who's to be known from now on as El Guerrillero Heroico, the heroic guerrilla. Frankly, I'm not too sure what all the fuss is about. Like every school child in Cuba, I know who Che is, because we have been taught how Che was the comandante in charge of the rebels during the Battle of Santa Clara, which was the turning point in the fighting back in 1958. I also know that later, después del triunfo, Fidel made Che a senior minister in charge of industry in the new revolutionary government, and even sent him to Russia to get some ideas about how to run a good communist economy. Even now, you sometimes come across Cuban revolutionary pesos signed by Che, when he was also head of the central bank back in the early days. But we haven't heard about Che for a long time, because at least 2 or 3 years ago, he just disappeared from public view. No one seems to know where he was, but that isn't all that strange in Cuba. Important people like ministers and comandantes in the revolutionary armed forces and Communist Party leaders even, can disappear from television or from newsreels without warning, and you never really know why, or if they are coming back. Then, in October 1965, Fidel said on television that Che had left Cuba for good and moved to Africa looking for nuevos campos de batallas, new battlefields against imperialists. No one has heard anything about Che since then, so you can see why some people are a little surprised by Fidel's announcement that Che has been killed in battle. Not in Africa, but in Bolivia. At the end of the 3-day mourning period, Fidel gives another big speech, and you can tell it's not going to be a happy speech, because El Máximo Líder looks and sounds as if he's died. His hair is all over the place, and his face is covered in sweat. And that is even before he starts. There are about 1 million people in the Plaza de la Revolución, the big square in Havana, where all the major rallies against the Americans are held, and all the Cuban flags are at half-mast. To one side of Fidel, up on the podium, there's a huge photograph of Che, as tall as the 10-story apartment block, looking heroic and revolutionary. Fidel says that while Che has died, he's still alive. One of my neighbourhood friends says this means Che is like one of those zombies you see in the movies. I'm sure he's only joking. The family of another of my neighbourhood friends have their own theories about the death of Che. They have told him that they think Fidel is to blame. They think that Che was sent to South America by Fidel to get rid of him, because he was becoming too much trouble for Fidel and for Fidel's brother Raúl. So they send him away to a place where the CIA could get at him and kill him. I know my friends' families are not communist. I think they may even be gusanos. But I don't know where they get these crazy counter-revolutionary ideas from. I think they're looking for trouble. The thing about Che dying is that now there's nothing on television, on the radio, or at the cinema but stories about Che. Even at school we have assemblies and meetings where we spend almost all day talking about Che and what a great example he is to Cuban children. At the end of all these meetings, right after we stand up to sing the national anthem, and sometimes too the international, we now say in a loud voice, "Seremos como el Che," we will be like Che, which means we will be true revolutionaries, not interested in money or material things, ready to fight the imperialist anywhere in the world. In October 1967, I have no idea that nearly 40 years later, photographs of Che in his trademark black beret will be plastered on expensive designer t-shirts, or that a film about his youth would be made not in Cuba, but in a capitalist country by capitalist filmmakers. And the film would make money, the very thing Che wanted to do away with. That's all way in the future, though. Right now, I'm at school listening to yet another reading of Che's diary in Bolivia. This happens every day. Che's diary of his time in Bolivia has been turned into a book, which has been published in record time in Cuba, and then distributed to every Cuban workplace, and every Cuban school, and every Cuban library, so we can all learn from his revolutionary example. Every day, at some time or other, we get an entry from Che's diary in Bolivia read to us in class. And while we may not be literary experts, my friends and I agree that the diaries are pretty heavy going. Still, we all sit quietly at our desks, listening to the teacher read on and on and on. Because if you say you don't want to grow up to be just like Che, you may have some explaining to do. In the cinema newsreel, there's footage of Fidel in his green uniform, which is all he ever seems to wear, holding two pineapples. But these are not ordinary pineapples. These are huge. They're as big as oversized watermelons. And Fidel is saying that these are the types of pineapples revolutionary scientists have developed in Cuba using the latest socialist technology. They're huge pineapples, and they are supposed to be tastier and meatier and a lot more juicy than ordinary capitalist pineapples. He says the pineapples are only in the development stage, but soon enough they will be growing all over Cuba so that every family in the country can eat as much pineapple as they want. There'll be so many giant pineapples, we'll be able to export them all over the world. This is what the revolution can do, El Máximo Líder says, holding two giant pineapples up for the cameras while everyone around him nods in approval and applause. This will show those junkies what we revolutionary Cubans can do by working hard. We're good at coming up with great ideas like these, we Cubans. Mind you, I know this isn't going to impress my father. It seems as if there's nothing Fidel can do that will impress him nowadays. And I know that when I tell my mother, she will say something like, "We haven't seen pineapples in the shop since 1960, which is true, of course, but does she have to be so counter-revolutionary? I don't care. I may not be allowed to join the communist pioneers, but I'm still a proud little Cuban, and I'm very proud that the revolution has managed to grow giant pineapples. So I tell them what I saw at the cinema, and sure enough, they're not impressed. My mother says, "We haven't even seen normal-sized pineapples in the shops for years." My father then says, "I hope this giant pineapple is not like the giant strawberries Fidel was talking about last year." Now, that comes as a shock. Giant strawberries? This is something entirely new to me. What are these giant strawberries I've never heard about? I know that when Fidel gave a speech to the Federation of Cuban Women, he promised them giant cows that would provide so much milk, everyone in Cuba would be drinking milk at breakfast, lunch, and even dinner. In fact, there would be so much milk from the giant cows, we would be selling milk to the Americans. I can just picture those embarrassed Americans having to drink Cuban milk. But I had never, ever heard about the giant tropical strawberries.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.